Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. Tonight, I'm going to do some pure science, and this is going to take the whole show, basically. But this past week, I've been, in fact, I read a book twice, and I've seen it before, and I actually helped write part of it, co-authored, although I don't really take credit for it. But there's a book by a friend of mine. His name is Mark Gaffney, and it's called Deep History and the Ages of Man. It's in its second edition right now on Amazon. And the crux of the issue is that Earth has had some pole shifts. And what I mean by a pole shift is a physical pole shift. And now, of course, you've probably heard about this, and this term gets used loosely, really loosely, all over the internet. Pole shift, yeah, pole shift, and, you know, Nibiru or whatever. But the reality is, not really hardly anybody on the internet understands the real mechanism for causing a pole shift. There were people who talked about magnetic pole shifts, and actually something called a magnetic pole shift happens all the time. You don't even know it. Doesn't cause the end of the world. Probably have one every couple weeks when there's a solar maximum, when we have a lot of solar activity going on. And it's actually an interaction of the solar wind along with our Earth's geomagnetic field. It's a field that surrounds Earth. Basically, it's a plasma field. It's the contribution from the physical magnetic field of the Earth. The fixed magnetic field of the Earth is actually very minimal. And if you take a Boy Scout compass, the kind you have a little needle and it shows north, you can actually see the magnetic field changing during a solar storm event. And they are actually mislabeled magnetic storms because scientists really don't know what causes them. They don't understand them. And so what's really going on is it's an electrical discharge that occurs relative to the solar wind and also to the solar capacitor, which surrounds our sun, and that is due to an excess current of protons that is always going on in the solar wind. So anyway, a magnetic pole shift occurs when the solar wind magnetic field comes in reverse. In other words, north is pointing towards what is normally south, and it's powerful enough to overcome our geomagnetic field, which is a plasma field. Solar wind is strong enough to overcome it, and it actually flips our magnetic field. And it's not a major event. Nobody dies. And this happens all the time, and it certainly does not cause a physical pole shift of our planet. So let's just clear the air of that to begin with. But during Earth's history, there have been many events where a large celestial object in the form of a comet would come by Earth. And if it comes over the North Pole or under the South Pole, and this is without hitting Earth, this is not a collision, this is a near passage of a passing large celestial body, but it would be in the form of a comet. So there are other effects, electrical, magnetic effects, pollution events, robbing one entity, robbing atmosphere from the other. And the list goes on, but I'm not going to concentrate on those tonight. And by the way, I apologize again for my voice. It's still very weak, but hopefully I'll be able to get through this show be able to complete an hour of talking. But I've had this kind of like thing. It's been going on for about a month now, and they say it lasts about a month. People have had this, it's like a cough, it's like bronchitis, basically. And if you look up anything about this, there's really nothing you can take for it. You're not supposed to take cough medicines or cross depressants or anything like that. So anyway, your body has to just work through this thing. Anyway, back to pole shifts. The idea of a pole shift is if you look at a globe, hopefully you have a globe in the house on a stand, and you'll notice that it's tilted. So the North Pole and the South Pole are canted, so to speak, and that's a 23.5 degree tilt. And that is because the Earth is literally, its axis is at an angle relative to the rest of the solar system, primarily the sun. So if you took a line between the Earth and the sun, it would be that defines what we call the ecliptic plane, the orbit of Earth. And by the way, if you were, say, an alien coming into our solar system and looking at our solar system for the very first time, you would not pick the base plate, a plane of the solar system to be commensurate with Earth's orbit. You would probably do it with Jupiter's orbit or possibly a composite of other planets together, but not Earth. Earth is very insignificant in gravitationally in terms of the entire solar system. So anyway, okay, back to this idea of Earth and the pole being shifted 23.5 degrees from the plane of the planet. Now, just to add a caveat here, something very important is the moon's orbit is at another angle relative to the ecliptic. And that's if it were perfectly aligned with Earth's orbit, that is the orbit of the moon, we would have a total solar eclipse and a total lunar eclipse every month. We'd have one each month. And so, but that doesn't happen because the Earth's orbit is tilted. And by the way, for you Trekkies out there, the people that think NASA breathes air and can do no wrong, one of the very excellent proofs of the fact that there have been major changes in orbital situations in our solar system, especially the inner solar system, is that the moon's orbit is canted away from the plane of the planets. Because here's what happens. When the moon is down below the plane of the planets, Earth and Jupiter pull up on it. And when the moon is above the plane of the planets and the plane of Jupiter's orbit, they pull down on it. So it's constantly working itself into the plane. So the fact that the moon's orbit is out of the plane of the planets tells you that that happened recently. Some recent celestial event occurred that caused our moon to have its orbit out of the plane of the planets. You can actually calculate how long it would take, and it's not that long astronomically or geologically. You might put it in terms like that. Okay, so anyway, but I'm not going to talk more about Earth's moon. I'm just going to talk about Earth itself. Now, to put this into perspective, we have had on planet Earth in the last, let's just put it into general terms, in the history of the Earth, we have had dozens of pole shifts where a large celestial object comes by Earth and basically sends a gravitational wave into the surface, the crust and the mantle, and these float on an inner core that's molten. Okay, so what has happening? It's like a soft boiled egg. And there's something you can do with a soft boiled egg that, here's the way it works. Take a soft boiled egg and take a hard boiled egg. In fact, you could take a hard boiled egg, a brand new egg that's not cooked at all, and an egg that is kind of just a little cooked enough to where the outside white part is starting to solidify, but all the rest of the egg inside is soft, just in its original, you know, liquid state. Okay, so now take the hard-boiled egg and spin it on a table. What happens when you spin it, you're holding the shell, you spin it, and since it's hard-boiled, all of the inner part of the egg is solid, and that spins too. Okay, so now take the completely soft egg, the fresh egg, and spin it on a table. And what you'll find is that the shell stops spinning. You go, well, why is that? Well, that's because when you spin the shell, the inside liquid is not connected to it. And so the inside liquid does not, the viscosity alone is not enough to make it spin at all. And so what happens is just the viscosity between the liquid and the shell makes the shell slow down and it stops spinning very quickly. So that's the difference between a fully hard-boiled egg and a soft-boiled egg. And the earth is like this. But the earth is closer to the one where the egg is cooked just a little bit. And of course, since the heat's coming in from the outside, the region right around the shell, just inside the shell, starts to solidify first. And that's what the earth is like. And then it has a molten core. Okay, so anyway, then the situation is like that on planet Earth. We have a crust where that we live up at the surface of the Earth. Then there's the mantle, which is a solid, kind of like a sphere inside the crust. And that floats on a molten core. So that's the construction of Earth. And then down deep inside, you have basically the core of Earth. There's actually two cores that they've detected using sounding, where they send sound and radar waves down through the ground, and then they reflect back. And it gives you a feeling for what is down there in Earth. But Earth's core is actually pretty big, and that's the original seed, the original comet seed, on which everything built up during the comet phases of development of Earth. Okay, and so those layers, all of that material built up over time. So that's why we really don't have any idea how old Earth is. So these clown scientists that pick up a surface rock and they do some kind of dating method, which doesn't even matter, because that rock has nothing to do with the inner part of the Earth. And there are literally no methods of getting down into that inner core of Earth to do, even if you could make some kind of test that made sense, which there really aren't any good methods. So we literally have no way of measuring the true age of planet Earth. So these clowns at NASA that run around and say 4.5 billion years old solar system, they don't know. It's just somebody repeating something, and as long as they repeat it, everybody gets a paycheck. But the real science is they have no idea. In fact, I've spent shows and a lot of time lecturing showing that really everything they teach you, if you took an astronomy, geology, meteorology, if you took all of these hard so-called, you know, space science, astrophysics courses in college, university level, or graduate student level, 99.9% of everything they say could not possibly be true. So I'm talking about cosmology, Big Bang, comet science, general relativity. All of this is just all garbage. Easily proven. So anyway, you'll see more and more on talk shows. Talk shows are having this very limited group of scientists who just repeat this stuff. And they, you know, they get a paycheck. Okay, so getting back to the Earth pole shift issue, So the Earth is more like the middle egg, the one that has a little bit of solid connected to the shell. And so it's going to continue spinning more than the complete soft-boiled egg, or the original egg, and it's not going to continue spinning certainly as much as the hard-boiled egg, which just keeps spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning. Okay, so the whole idea is that when there is a pole shift, the number one thing you start out with is what cannot cause a pole shift. Because people have throughout the ages realized, hey, you know, there's been some pole shift type of activity. Okay, that's very good. Like a guy named Hapgood. And so what his idea was that ice would build up on one side of the North Pole and would just keep building up on that one side due to some unknown climatological or weather type of weather pattern or something, that all of a sudden one side of Earth would get all of this snow, and then that weight would somehow move the crust and mantle of Earth and cause a pole shift. And when you look at it, it simply does not work. You know, the only thing that's going to do is make the Earth wobble a little bit. But as soon as that melts and goes away, which it is right now, there's no lobe of ice or anything on planet Earth right now, then that wobbling would stop and there's not going to be a pole shift. Okay, so anyway, the bottom line is that the Earth of itself cannot, never will, have a pole shift on its own. So then you have the camp of people like NASA who deny anything happening from outer space other than maybe a little asteroid hitting Earth every now and then and pretending that it wiped out the dinosaurs, which it didn't. The craters that they found did not even cause mass extinctions locally, let alone on an Earth-wide scale. So you have this contingency of pole shift deniers, let's call them, who populate NASA and the universities, the Ivory Tower universities. And they are literally sitting on laurels that are, we're pushing centuries old. Okay, so the only way that Earth can have a pole shift, if it's affected from outside by an outside force. Now, I want to give an example here of the gymnast. We've all seen videos, a lot of people recently posting videos of gymnasts. And it might be the long jump. How about the people who are gymnasts and they do flips and amazing, amazing, you know, doon-doon-doon-doon, head-over-heels type of flips, running down these padded mats and flipping. Or how about the parallel bar athletes or the rings where they hang from rings and they do all kinds of exercises. So all of these different types of gymnastics, or people who do like circus acts where the flying trapeze, there they flip and they catch each other and they flip off to a different trapeze and swing back and forth at timed, etc. Okay, so all of these acrobatic acts depend on the athlete using force. Or let's talk about wrestling. I'm not talking about the WWE TV wrestling where they're jumping around. I'm talking about real wrestlers who are physical contact, trying to change and turn the body of the other one to get them into debilitating positions, etc., so they can win the match. All of these require a mat or something to push against. Can you imagine two wrestlers? Okay, let's put it this way. Take two wrestlers, put them out in the middle of outer space. There's no gravity, there's no mat, there's nothing to push against, and they're going to try and wrestle. It's like, what? No, it would be impossible because There's no way to get leverage. There's no way to get advantage. There's no way to push on something to get a force on the other person. Or take all of these acrobatic acts into outer space and take away the rings, the bars, the mats, the whatever they're using, take those away. Now, how are they going to do flips and jumps and somersaults? And, how about this one, too? This is a very good one. Let's take the competition skater, ice skating. And so now what they do, for example, what they'll do is they'll go into a spin on their skates with their arms out as far as they can stretch them, and then they pull them in, and then they spin really fast, and then they let their arms out, and they slow down. That's a good system, a good example of conservation of angular momentum. So the weight, it's a combination of the mass versus the radius. And if you pull your arms in, then the radius decreases greatly, and then you spin faster to conserve angular momentum. It's a very good example. And you could do that in outer space all day long, but you're not going to change your angle of axis. You're not going to change the axis because the angular momentum revolves around that axis. Okay? It would take something physical from outside for that skater, if they were doing this in outer space with nothing around, they would never, ever be able to change their axis of angular momentum. And that's what we're talking about with planet Earth. Planet Earth on its own, which it's doing, it's out in outer space, spinning around, of its own, planet Earth cannot have a change in angular momentum. So how could you have a pole shift where the North Pole shifts up to a few thousand miles all on its own? It's simply not going to happen. It's against the laws of physics. It cannot happen. It simply cannot happen. So that gets us back to the point where we now know, in fact, this is, I'm going to refer back to this, and I highly recommend that you read two books. One of them is the book by Mark Gaffney, Deep History and the Ages of Man. It's in its second edition on Amazon. So once again, Deep History and the Ages of Man. And then read my most recent book, which is The Real History of Man and Earth, Myths, Magic, and Mayhem. Now, when Mark was writing his book, going back to the first edition and working through the second edition, he was in contact with me and other people that he references in the book. And getting an understanding of how this process works of pole shifts, the physical process of pole shifts. And the reason, of course, he asked me is because I know how it works. My second book in my series is called Surviving Planet X Passage. And in it, there's diagrams that I hand drew and put in there showing how a physical pole shift works, how the a large object comes by, and what are the factors involved. Well, this is basically what we call tidal forces, or differential forces is another word, or another term in physics is 1 over r cubed force. It's a short-range force, and here's how it works. And the moon does this all the time on planet Earth. We have tides on planet Earth that are caused by primarily the moon, somewhat in conjunction with the sun. But there again, because of the moon's proximity, the moon is the dominant factor in our tides, not the sun. You'd go, well, gee, the sun is a lot bigger. That should really be our main effect on tides, but it's this 1 over r cubed thing that only the closest objects really have an effect. And if you're really close, then they have a big effect. That's the weird thing about tidal forces. So what is going on with the moon and Earth? Well, Earth is spinning on its axis. We have a day every 24 hours. So in every 24 hours, Earth spins around once on its axis. And the moon is going around Earth once every about 28 days. So basically, the moon is relatively still as Earth spins underneath it. And what happens? There's a force between the Earth and the moon, and then the moon, likewise, Newton's law, equal and opposite forces. The moon is pulling back on planet Earth, but it's not equal. If you look at the side of Earth that's closest to the moon, the oceans, and even the land mass, because the moon is closer, it pulls harder there than it does on the center of the Earth. And if you go to the far side of Earth from the moon is pulling there too, but since it's farther away, it pulls less, so there's a bulge that comes out. So there's a bulge that comes out of Earth's middle towards the moon and then the other side away from the moon. So these are tidal bulges. That's what they're called. And they can be up to 20 feet in height. This happens every day as the Earth passes under the moon. Now, there's also about a 1-inch rise in the land mass, and that's why during, say, a full moon, or a new moon even, there can be extenuated tidal effects and even earthquakes that are more frequent during a full moon or a new moon. That's when the moon and the sun are aligned and their tidal forces act together by adding. So you can get additional forces, and so the Earth's surface actually rises about an inch at the same time as the oceans are rising many feet due to the same tidal force. Okay, so it's the tidal force or differential force that is causing this wave to move around planet Earth. The other thing is that this is moving very fast along the surface of the Earth. So how fast is fast? Well, it's about 1,000 miles per hour. The Earth is 25,000 miles in circumference, and as it spins once per day. So that means that about every day, the Earth's surface, that center part, is moving at around 25,000 miles in a day, then 24 hours. And that comes out to be roughly 1,000 miles per hour at the equator. So that's how fast the Earth is actually spinning. And it turns out that that creates quite a bit of force. And that's where the tidal forces come from to create the tides of the world in the oceans. And also, like I said, you can measure these on the land. Okay, so what are the factors? How close is the moon? If it were closer, we would have bigger tides. If it were farther away, we would have lower tides. But another factor is how fast is it moving relative to the surface of the Earth. And this has to do with impulses. A lot of times, like, say, you took a nail and you're going to try and hammer it into a board. You take your hammer and you just take the hammer and you press on the nail. You don't hit the hammer. You just press on the nail. Well, it would be very difficult to push that nail into the board by just pushing on it. So what do? You swing the hammer, and when that hammer comes down, all of the energy into that moving hammer goes into the nail, drives the nail into the wood. Okay, so that is called impulse. The harder you swing the hammer, the faster you swing that hammer, the more impulse there is, and the more you drive that nail into the piece of wood. So it's an impulse. Now, if you have, the moon basically is moving across the surface of the Earth at 1,000 miles per hour. That's the effect of the tidal effect of the moon. What if you had something much bigger than the moon? It was coming much closer than the moon and was coming much faster than 1,000 miles an hour. And that wouldn't be hard to do. We know that there's stuff flying around out there that's moving at very high velocities, very, very high velocities. But now if you look at something that would be really big in size and say, okay, what's it going to do in this scenario, put it in the factors, we can actually calculate the effect. And the end effect of something, let's say not as big as Jupiter, let's say something like Uranus, which is still much bigger than Earth, and coming by Earth at 10 times the speed of the moon. And let's say that it's coming very close to Earth, much closer than the moon. Now you have the potential, instead of just a ocean wave, which you would still have, much, much bigger, you would also have land waves. Now, if the comet were big enough, this is the comet nucleus, planet-sized object, and remember that the comets are the discharge of the solar capacitor, so any object that comes into the solar system is going to discharge the solar capacitor and form a comet. So it's small, medium, large. So in this case, we're talking about the really big stuff, things that are Earth size or bigger in the nucleus of a comet. And we know for a fact that there have been some potentially the size of Jupiter that have come near Earth back throughout history. It caused absolutely incredible damage and extinction level events, etc. Okay, so now this is the theory, this is the understanding, this is the physics of how pole shifts work. Now let's go back to the egg example. What is the gravitational wave doing when you take that medium boiled egg, the one that has just a little bit of hardness in the inside, right inside the shell, and you spin it? Most of the egg is viscous, but part of it is solid. So that's going to continue moving in the direction that you gave initially the spin, the initial spin. Remember, the hard-boiled egg, the Earth is not like the hard-boiled egg where you spin it, and everything inside the egg spins along with the shell because it's all solid, and that thing keeps on spinning. Okay, now in the case of the large planetary object coming by Earth, not hitting Earth, just coming by and sending that impulse gravitational wave, and remember, it's the impulse because it happens so fast. It's like the hammer hitting the nail. It's not just moving by slowly like the moon in its orbit or Earth spinning underneath the moon. This thing is coming fast. And so wham, that gravitational pulse hits the Earth's surface, and this is within a 12-hour period that this happens, where you have a 1,000-foot land wave moving across the land at, say, 20,000 miles an hour. When that wave in the land, that energy in the land, hits an existing obstruction on Earth, it could be an existing mountain range, guess where all that energy is going to go? It's going to be like a wave on the ocean hitting the beach. All of that energy gets absorbed. But tremendous amount of energy, so that's where mountain building comes from. That is the cause of mountains being built, are these tremendous impulses that come by when a large comet passes through the solar system, and by chance, not all of them come near Earth, and that's one of the big fallacies of the disinformation campaign over Planet X, that no, these objects don't come by Earth every time. In fact, the vast majority of them miss. It's only on rare, rare occasions when these big objects come close to planet Earth and cause a lot of damage. That's just simply the way it is. Okay, so now we've got the physical part of the pole shift in tow. And there's one other little caveat here for those of you who that may be a little bit more advanced. This only is going to cause a pole shift if the object passes over the North Pole or under the South Pole, and it could be in either direction, coming or going, over the North Pole or over the South Pole. What happens is if the object comes around, say, over the equator, then what it's going to do is it's still going to cause a mountain building event, or certainly disrupt the land, causing, you know, kicking off volcanoes, big tsunamis, mountain building, land that was under the ocean will be thrown up, and land that was above the ocean will be thrown down, and just a big hodgepodge of effects. And in my book, the weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, I go through about 20 of the major Earth effects that occur after during a close passage of a large celestial object by planet Earth, or any other planet, as a matter of fact. So, just to make that clear again, it's only when these objects come over the poles that you actually get a pole shift. Now, if it comes kind of three quarters or at an angle, then the pole shift will be somewhat minimized because it's not coming directly over the pole. And so that's one thing that in looking at these events in history or in the geological record, it's really difficult to sort all this out because these objects are not going to always come in a very nice, perfect path over the pole. It's just not going to happen. Occasionally it might happen. And I think that's the case with the last one we know about, is the Venus event, where the comet Venus came by Earth and had two major interactions, actually. But and in that case, the estimate is that the pole shift was about 2,000 miles. Okay, now there's all kinds of after effects, because if the old North Pole had been there for any period of time, then because of the spinning on its axis, etc., the old magnetic field would be coupled with the old location. And so it's important to understand that the old magnetic field, which is now coupled with the old North Pole, has shifted. And so that magnetic field, North Pole, is going to start to migrate to work up to where the new North Pole is. And you can see that actually happening on Earth. Since the beginning of recorded time, the Earth's magnetic field has, we've known the direction of that field. And so what's been going on from the very early explorers of the North American continent, we've understood that the old North Pole was near Baffin Island, where the old North Pole was, the old physical North Pole. The old magnetic pole was there also, but after the pole shift, the most recent one, the magnetic pole has been migrating up to the location of the new axis North Pole of Earth. And so anyway, that's a very interesting thing to see. So we're seeing the actual remnants of the old magnetic field migrating up to become one with the new or current magnetic field. And there's a lot of people who don't understand these issues. Once you start putting all of these things together, they all just make a lot of sense. Okay, so I'm going to come back to the physical part of this later in the show. Hopefully I have a few minutes at the end to kind of tie up some loose ends here. But now I'm going to jump into this book by Mark Gaffney. And of course, I've talked about this a long time ago. In the mid-1990s, I went to Mexico. I took a surveying transit, surveying equipment, and I had some assistants also. And I carried this equipment, these big, heavy cases of equipment, down to the Yucatan Peninsula, where I was when I was a young person. When I was down in the Yucatan, in my early 20s, I lived in Mexico. I spent a lot of my time in the Yucatan Peninsula at Mayan ruins, at looking at other ruins, being on ruin sites as they were being dug up, etc. So I knew my way around. So I took this equipment down there, and I surveyed a number of the locations, including Chichen Itza and Uxmal and Tulum, and some other locations out in the jungle, etc., and realized that they were not on a north, south, east, west basis, according to our current North Pole. So in taking these various cities, which had been built upon old cities, I used triangulation and some maps and globes, etc., and realized that I had found, basically by triangulation, the old North Pole. And I put it up north of the state of Michigan in the province of Ontario near Hudson Bay. Okay, there are other people that had done other types of work also claiming, and this is Charles Hapgood is another person that did this type of research, and he was back like in the 50s, commensurate, contemporaneous with Velikovsky, who also talked about pole shifts. My aspect of this was to find boots on the ground evidence that there was, in fact, alignments of these ancient cities with the old North Pole, and then physically examine it, but not only that, but to give the physical explanation, because, of course, my three-part comet paper that was came out, you know, in the 1979-81 time frame, and published, but talked about pole shifts, etc., and of course supporting the idea of Velikovsky. So now fast forward up to the modern era here, where we have Google Maps and other forms of assistance, where you can zoom in on like an archaeological site and then do ley lines that travel. You can mark the grid work of the archaeological site and then follow that. And it turns out that many of these follow lines to the positions of old historically known North Pole locations. So this is not something that happened just one time in Earth's history. Velikovsky studied one such event, what I call the Venus event, where Venus, the comet, came through the solar system and wreaked havoc on Earth on two different occasions. And there were many others within historical time. And you have to understand, too, when you find a lot of these ruins, there's just nothing there. And the people were living there when this disaster hit, whatever it was, and just simply wiped it clean. I mean, there's not like these coastal cities of Peru. 40 million people living there and not a potsherd, not a piece of clay, nothing, no trace of people at all. So a wave came in, a tremendous wave, and simply washed it all out to sea. And I suspect if we ever have the technology available, will I be able to go out into the ocean off the coast of Peru, and we'll find a bountiful amount of human existence. The other thing that happened was the ocean levels changed dramatically between 300 and 600 feet. So a tremendous change in the ocean levels, a change in the equatorial bulge of Earth, etc. But what's very interesting is that the science now can follow animals. And for example, one of the best ones, and this is a very amazing research. Mark Gaffney is the kind of person that, by the way, he's the person that started Earth Day, which just happened, April 20th or 22nd, I forget the date. Just recently, this last week, was Earth Day. Mark Gaffney started Earth Day at Boulder's Colorado State University in Boulder, Colorado, 1970. He started the first Earth Day, which then exploded into what it is today. In fact, I think there's actually Earth Month now. But Mark started the first Earth Day, to give you an idea. And he's been, has amazing career of writing books, of doing studies. And he's been a fan of mine for a very long time. And so when he wrote this book, Deep History and Ages of Man, he was in communication with me extensively throughout the writing. And the second half of the book actually concentrates pretty much on my work that explains pole shifts and how they work. It does a very good job of explaining how this works to the general public without overwhelming you like I sometimes do with too much information for the average public. But at any rate, take, for example, the mollusks. When there was a pole shift, these mollusks, which are a shelled sea animal, have a very small temperature range where they can exist. And so what happens is in their larva stage, the ocean currents take the larva, and they are constantly trying to expand their area, but typically they stay very localized. But in case of a major Earth, like a pole shift, there's a mechanism for these seashell animals to migrate within a single season or two, because these pole shifts happen very quickly and cause a tremendous change in the temperature of water. So it's one of the very good indicators that there was a pole shift. Or how about the woolly mammoths or the mastodons, in that mass extinction of animals that occurred at the end of the, or at the beginning of the Holocene period, which is the modern age of man, basically. But the other thing that's very interesting here is they're starting to realize now that a lot of these artifacts, cities, the Great Pyramids, the structures at the Mayans, the Aztecs, etc., a lot of these were there potentially hundreds of thousands of years ago. And the history of man who really built them has been completely erased because of these tremendous just ocean wave tsunamis that have just literally washed Earth clean of any trace of the people that lived there. And man somehow has survived up to his current state. The other issue is that we're going to have some of these again. They don't happen very often. These things do not happen but once in a very long time. And now this makes a very interesting point, reanalyzing what Velikovsky did. Velikovsky attributed many things, and this is one of the things that happens when people start researching this, is they go, oh, there was one event, and that's happening again today with people like Graham Hancock or other groups of scientists that are going, oh, there was one event, a comet hit Earth 11,000 years ago. And then all of this, all of these cities that we see, they're saying, oh, they all went under at that point. And no, the whole point here is that there were many, many of these events. The human race rose, got up to the point, in some cases, probably where they were spacefaring, had technologies that we do not even comprehend today, cutting big obelisks and rocks that weigh hundreds, thousands of tons, and then moving them over great distances and setting them up in the what we attribute them to is some race where they were slaves pulling these things around with loincloths. absolutely absurd, absolutely absurd, where it just simply didn't happen. And so what we're realizing, yeah, the pharaohs did not build the Egyptian pyramids. They came in and basically took them over. There was an advanced civilization, you know, in culture, etc., that advanced, but certainly not to the point where they could have built these structures. And so Mark is saying that we had four pole shifts in the last 120,000 years. And the last major one occurred about 11,000 to 12,000 years ago at the beginning of the Holocene period, which makes a very interesting point that the Velikovsky-Venus event was a major Earth-wide event, and that's what is referred to as Quetzalcoatl. There's no doubt about it in the Mayan mythology, but that it was not as major an event as what we've attributed it to, including myself. I'm going to just say that this is not settled at all. But what is settled is that these clowns sitting around in universities, all pretending that none of this ever happened, are simply going to go by the wayside. There are a lot of people now realizing, many of them amateurs, that, yeah, the drilling of holes in hard granite or the construction of big boxes that are made out of the hardest material on Earth, precision cut, 10 meters long, 20, 30 meters long, precision cut and then engraved, just in, you know, in intricate engravings, etc. And we have no idea. We could not do it today with the best laser technology, with the best cutting technology that exists today. We would not be able to duplicate what they have done. And they certainly did not do it with copper tools or bronze or iron or any other materials that they had accessible at the time. Simply is not possible. Okay, now we have to throw in something else, which is very interesting, and this is dealing with the deep history of man, our species, the human being has been like this. The idea that man somehow evolved out of, you know, the last 5,000 years in Mesopotamia is completely false. The idea that man crossed the Bering Strait from the China region, Mongolia, to populate the North American, Central American, and South American continents is simple absurdity. It's just absolutely, you know, there's no truth to this at all. Yeah, people still repeat it. You know, the idea that the dinosaurs died from an asteroid strike, completely absurd, not true at all. So, like I say, almost everything you look at that is being taught today is simply could not possibly be true, especially regarding the history of man. Okay, so now we have another little innuendo here. It's called the Noah's Flood. Now, when the Noah's Flood was occurring, it was Earth passing through the tail of a large comet. And I made a calculation one time based on the comet Hale-Bopp, which was actually not that big a comet compared to some of the really, really big ones that have historically passed through the solar system. And remember that the big ones are very rare. But if Earth would have passed through the tail of Comet Hale-Bopp, it would have taken about 40 days and 40 nights. We would have had an Earth-wide flood, inundation flood worldwide. The ocean levels would have risen by hundreds of feet. It would have destroyed man, except for the few remnants that were able to possibly be on the highest mountains, or in caves on the highest mountains, or in a boat like Noah built, etc. So, and that was not a pole shift. That was just Earth passing through the tail of a comet. So we have many of these comet-related events that have drastically affected the history of man. And the question, of course, the big question is, could this happen in the future? And the answer is that yes, it's going to happen in the future, but at this point in time, we have absolutely no information, and I'm privy to a lot of insider information. There's absolutely no indication that there's anything going on at this time that would cause us to fear into the near future. The biggest problem for man today is not from outer space. It's man himself, the criminal, the absolute criminal, deranged element that is running governments around the world today. That's the problem for man, not coming from outer space. So at any rate, I'm going to take the last minute here to talk about the water filters. The sale is ending Sunday. Big discount on the MR5 whole house water filter. And you can find that on my webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. Once again, jmccwaterfilters.com. And also, my book is for sale, the one I was talking to you about. It's on Amazon. It's called The Real History of Man and Earth, Myths, Magic, and Mayhem. And then also this book by Mark Gaffney, 300 pages. It's a pretty deep, involved read, but very much worth it. It's called Deep History and the Ages of Man. That's something like if you go on vacation or have a long airplane trip or something, get that book and read it. That'd be a time when you don't have interruptions. Because it's a very dense book. It takes some very... He's done a lot of research and he's put a lot of information together. And like I say, the second half of the book concentrates on my work explaining the history of man relative to the science that we know about today. So very, very important work. And it really extends out into the true scientific world, talking about the real history of man, where you just have, unlike you've seen it before. And it really starts to make sense because now we can coordinate mass extinctions and the change in climates that happened around those mass extinctions with actual physical pole shift events. Very, very important, very, very crucial work. And like I say, the universities, NASA people are going to go on, you know, collecting their paycheck, but just ignore them. That's the only thing you can do with standard science, is to ignore them. Once again, the sale on the MR5 filters ends this Sunday. And so go to the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.